Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. Today on the show, I answer a listener question for our program, Ask a Teacher. You will also hear a report from Susan Shand. And we close the show with an American story. But first,
the flags hanging outside Anwar Rakwa's house near the Indonesian city of Palu have led to warnings from the police. But the 50-year-old fisherman promises he is not taking them down. The police were not there to help when he was the only one in his community to survive the tsunami that hit Palu last September. Neither were the government or aid organizations that came to the affected area in the hard-to-reach part of the island of Sulawesi. Instead, the first people to offer him hope and a new boat were members of a conservative Islamic group known for violent acts. All this time, I had often been offered similar assistance from various organizations, government and non-government, but they only made promises, Rakwa said. Today, the Islamic Defenders Front's white and green flag hangs outside Rakwa's house. So does a large black flag with white Arabic writing. Flags similar to it have become linked with violent extremism.
Since the Islamic Defenders Front group was established 20 years ago, it has pushed for Islamic law to govern the lives of Indonesia's 230 million Muslims. The group's leaders aim to correct what they see as the errors of Indonesia's 1945 constitution, which established a secular state and religious freedom. The group has recently had some unexpected and surprising political victories. Its successes are only partly due to the growth of conservative Islam in Indonesia. The group's success also can be linked to a 10-year effort to repurpose its militia. It has turned its fighters into a force that is skilled at helping the poor and searching for victims of natural disasters. Researchers say members of Indonesia's military formed the Islamic Defenders Front after the fall of former President Suharto in 1998. They say the group formed as a tool for dealing with pro-democracy activists and liberalism. The group was able to act without fear of punishment from the law, and it became known for criminal activities and violent attacks. It now has members in 23 of Indonesia's 34 provinces and a military-like command structure. Maman Suryadi Abdurrahman is the head of the Front's Islamic Defender Troops militia. He told the Associated Press the organization has 1 million members. Researchers have said its membership is much smaller, estimating that it numbers in the tens of thousands.
The group does not propose that Indonesia become a caliphate, a state run by an Islamic ruler. Instead, the group says it wants Islamic law to govern the 9 out of 10 Indonesian citizens who are Muslim. Its leaders wear the red and white Indonesian flag on their official clothing and often work with nationalistic causes. The group says it has eased some of its violent methods, but it still forcefully deals with what it calls community diseases, such as sex work, same-sex relationships, and celebrations of Western holidays. It does so, it says, at the request of local communities. "We've tried to improve our image," Abdurrahman said. "We've changed the ways of our demonstrations to be more persuasive and peaceful. In doing so, it has followed the same path as other deeply conservative groups in Indonesia, including Hizbut Tahrir. This group, which does seek a caliphate, was banned last year." Alexander Arifianto is an Indonesian politics expert at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore. He said Indonesian groups copied Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, which led Islamic charities in the 1970s and 1980s and became very popular.
The Islamic Defenders Front's aid effort is known as Red Crescent Indonesia. It is not part of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, but it was very busy last year. Along with the Palu disaster that killed more than 4,000 people, earthquakes killed hundreds and destroyed thousands of homes on the island of Lombok. A tsunami also caused major damage on the Sunda Strait coastlines of Java and Sumatra. Indonesia is made up of 17,000 islands. Its central government has often been accused of ignoring hard-to-reach areas far from Java, the center of political and economic power. But the Islamic Defenders Front was right there at each disaster. Its members searched for victims, gave out aid, and built temporary housing and new religious centers. Its usual social services, such as free health care, have become important for poor people in cities. The Front's rising political power was notable in 2016 and 2017 when it organized hundreds of thousands to protest the Christian governor of the capital, Jakarta. And in April's presidential election, the Front backed former general Prabowo Subianto. He won a large majority of votes in religiously conservative provinces. However, President Joko Widodo won re-election by appealing to less conservative and minority voters. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Film director Martin Scorsese has made his second film about singer and winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, Bob Dylan. The film mixes fact and imaginative fiction. Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story, will be released on Netflix and in limited movie theaters on Wednesday. It shows one of the singer's strangest musical tours, his 1975 trip around the United States. That tour had the playfulness of old vaudeville performances, and much of it was captured on film. The Rolling Thunder tour included singers Joni Mitchell, Joan Baez, and Roger McGuinn, as well as the poet Allen Ginsberg. Rock and roll singer Mick Ronson also joined the group. They played in small theaters without much publicity, although Dylan was a major star at the time. It wasn't a success, not if you measure success in terms of profit, but it was an adventure, Dylan says in Scorsese's film. Dylan shaped some of what Cameron shot in the 1978 film Rinaldo and Clara. Critics and audiences hated it. Dylan never again tried to direct a film. Scorsese's movie is taken from over 100 hours of film footage shot in 1975. It has commentary from Dylan and Baez, with interviews with Sharon Stone and other actors who tell untrue stories about their supposed involvement with the tour. "We are not calling it a documentary," said Margaret Bodie. She is one of the producers. Scorsese used a different method in his earlier movie about Dylan. No Direction Home from 2005 was a traditional documentary about the singer's early life. In the 1960s, Dylan changed from someone who left college to sing folk music to an international rock star. The new film shows Dylan in 1975 performing songs such as Mr. Tambourine Man and Knockin' on Heaven's Door in white face paint. There's just a certain kind of connection to the audience that he seemed to have on this tour that I think will blow everyone's minds, Bodie said. The movie's fictional stories really grew out of the spirit of the tour, she said, because Bob looks so different on that tour, and he's kind of an actor. I'm Susan Shand.
In today's Ask a Teacher, learning English follower Shah Ram is struggling with a certain word. He wrote to us,
"Please explain the word struggle. I get confused about it."
Thanks for writing, Shah Ram. We hope you will be completely at peace with struggle by the end of this program. Struggle can be a verb or a noun. A simple definition of the verb struggle is to work very hard to try to gain something. You might use all your energy struggling for control of a ball in a sport, for example. Or you might spend a lot of time and brain power searching for a solution to a problem. Here are some example sentences.
My son is struggling to pass math this term. He works for hours every night to understand fractions.
Or,
the baby bird had to struggle to spread its wings and fly.
Struggle is often used in terms of moral, social, and political goals. A recent VOA Learning English headline read, "Women with albinism struggle for acceptance." The story told about a movement to end discrimination against people with a medical condition that leaves their skin very light in color. Next, we turn to the meaning of the word struggle when it is used as a noun. Merriam-Webster's online dictionary defines the noun struggle as an act of strongly motivated striving. When struggle is a noun, the or a often comes before it. For example, we can return to our earlier sentence about the math student.
It is a struggle for my son to learn fractions.
Struggle as a noun is often used when people are talking about social movements. You might have heard the phrase, the struggle for civil rights in America, or the struggle to end apartheid, or a struggle for freedom. A commonly used term in political news reports is power struggle. This often refers to different political parties or individuals fighting to control a government or a policy issue. Hope that helps, Sharam. And to all our English learners, please keep your questions coming to Ask a Teacher.
Our story today is called Paul's Case. It was written by Willa Cather. Paul's Case will be told in two parts. Here is Kay Gallant with part one of the story.
Paul hated school. He did not do his homework. He did not like his teachers. Paul's father did not know what to do with him. His teachers did not know either. One afternoon, all his teachers at Pittsburgh High School met together with him to discuss his case. Paul was late. When he entered the room, his teachers sat waiting for him. He was tall for his age and very thin. His clothes were too small for him, but they were clean. He had a bright red flower in the buttonhole of his black jacket. One of the teachers asked Paul why he had come to the meeting. Paul said politely that he wanted to do better in school. This was a lie. Paul often lied. His teachers began to speak. They had many complaints. One said Paul talked to the other students instead of paying attention to the lessons. Another said Paul always sat in class with his hands covering his eyes. A third teacher said Paul looked out the window instead of looking at her. His teachers attacked him without mercy. Paul's eyebrows moved up and down as his teacher spoke. His smile never left his face, but his fingers shook as he touched the flower on his coat. At last, the meeting was over. Paul's smile got even wider. He bowed gracefully and left the room. His teachers were angry and confused. The art teacher spoke for all of them when he said there was something about Paul that he didn't understand. "I don't think he really means to be bad," he said. "There's just something wrong with that boy." Then the art teacher remembered one warm afternoon when Paul had fallen asleep in his class. Paul's face was white, with thin blue veins under the skin. The boy's face looked tired and lined, like an old man's. His eyebrows moved up and down, even in his sleep. After he left the meeting, Paul ran down the hill from the school, whistling. He was late for his job at the concert hall. Paul was an usher there. He showed people to their seats. He carried messages for them. He brought them their programs with a polite bow. Everyone thought he was a charming boy and the best usher at the hall. When Paul reached the concert hall that evening, he went immediately to the dressing room. About six boys were already there. Paul began changing his clothes with excited hands. He loved his green uniform with the gold pockets and design. Paul rushed into the concert hall as soon as he had changed clothes. He ran up and down the hall, helping people. He became more and more excited. His face became pink, and his eyes seemed larger and very bright. He looked almost handsome. At last, everyone was seated. The orchestra began to play, and Paul sat down with a sigh of relief. The music seemed to free something in Paul's spirit. Then a woman came out and began to sing. She had a rich, strong soprano voice. Paul felt truly happy for the first time that day. At the end of the concert, Paul went back to the dressing room. After he had changed his clothes again, he went outside the concert hall. He decided to wait for the singer to come out. While he waited, he looked across the street to the large hotel called the Schenley. All the important people stayed at the Schenley when they visited Pittsburgh. Paul had never been inside it, but he used to stand near the hotel's wide glass doors. He liked to watch the people enter and leave. He believed if he could only enter this kind of a hotel, he would be able to leave school, his teachers, and his ordinary gray life behind him forever. At last, the singer came out of the concert hall. Paul followed her as she walked to the hotel. He was part of a large crowd of admirers who had waited to see her. When they all reached the hotel, she turned and waved. Then the doors opened and she disappeared inside. Paul stared into the hotel as the doors slowly closed. He could feel the warm, sweet air inside, and for a moment he felt part of a golden world of sparkling lights and marble floors. He thought about the mysterious dishes of food being served in the hotel's dining room. He thought about green bottles of wine growing cold in silver buckets of ice. He turned away from the hotel and walked home. He thought of his room with its horrible yellow wallpaper, the old bed with its ugly red cover. He shook his head. Soon he was walking down the street where he lived. All the houses on Cordelia Street were exactly alike. Middle-class businessmen had bought them for their families. All their children went to school and to church. They loved arithmetic. As Paul walked toward his house, he felt as if he were drowning in ugliness. He longed for cool colors and soft lights and fresh flowers. He didn't want to see his ugly bedroom or the cold bathroom with its cracked mirror and gray floor. Paul went around to the back of his father's house. He found an open window and climbed into the kitchen. Then he went downstairs to the basement. He was afraid of rats, but he did not want to face his own bedroom. Paul couldn't sleep. He sat on the floor and stared into the darkness until morning came. The following Sunday, Paul had to go to church with his family. Afterwards, everyone came home and ate a big dinner. Then all the people who lived on Cordelia Street came outside to visit each other. After supper, Paul asked his father if he could visit a friend to get some help with his arithmetic. Paul left the house with his school books under his arm, but he didn't go to his friend's house. Instead, he went to see Charlie Edwards. Charlie was a young actor. Paul liked to spend as much time as he could at the theater, where Charlie Edwards and his group acted in their plays. It was only at the theater and the concert hall that Paul felt really alive. The moment he smelled the air of these places, he felt like a prisoner suddenly set free. As soon as he heard the concert hall orchestra play, he forgot all the ugly, unpleasant events in his own life. Paul had discovered that any kind of music awakened his imagination. Paul didn't want to become a musician, however. He didn't want to become an actor, either. He only wanted to be near people who were actors and musicians. He wanted to see the kind of life these artists led. Paul found the schoolroom even worse after a night at the theater or the concert hall. He hated the school's bare floors and cracked walls. He turned away from his dull teachers in their plain clothes. He tried to show them how little he thought of them and the studies they taught. He would bring photographs of all the actors he knew to school. He would tell the other students that he spent his evenings with these people at elegant restaurants. Then he would announce that he was going away to Europe or to California or to Egypt for a while. The next day, he would come to school smiling nervously. His sister was ill, he would say, but he was still planning to make his trip next spring. Paul's problems at school became worse. Even after the meeting with his teachers, things did not get better. He told them he had no time to study grammar and arithmetic. He told them he had to help the actors in the theater. They were old friends of his. Finally, his teachers went to Paul's father. He took Paul out of school and made him get a job. He told the manager at the concert hall that Paul could not work there anymore. His father warned the doorman at the theater not to let Paul into the place. And Charlie Edwards promised Paul's father not to see Paul again. All the actors at the theater laughed when they heard about the stories Paul had been telling. The women thought it was funny that Paul had told people he took them out to nice restaurants and sent them flowers. They agreed with the teachers and with his father that Paul's was a bad case.
That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.